Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, today it's a new take on coffee. What the coffee professionals think about roasts, seasons, and why cheap is good when it comes to brewing coffee. Our guest is master roaster and coffee buyer Kevin Knox. You are in for some surprises here, including the relationship between your latte and what you grill your steak over. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan takes on one of the most confusing wines around, sherries. She's going to explain the different types and how to enjoy them. Our tea guy, Bill Waddington, has the inside stories on tea, like the James Bond-style tale about how tea first got to England. Then British novelist Jim Crace tells us about a life lesson in pygmy oranges. And as always, in the second half of the show, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. That number's 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So you two, where have you been wandering?
We have been wandering in the land of the pig, i.e. the American South. And one of the things that we've been thinking about is the relationships of religion to pork in the great barbecues of the Deep South in the United States. It's almost a sure thing that if you walk into a barbecue and you see images of pigs and religious homilies on the wall, you are about to eat a terrific meal.
You mean in the barbecue joint there will be religious sayings?
Absolutely, without a doubt. At Harold's Barbecue in Atlanta, Georgia, which we're about to tell you about, a wonderful place. It's been there for decades. On the wall, you see a sign that says, God has time to listen if you have time to pray. And in that saying, I think, is the key to the connection between great barbecue and religion, and that is a sense of patience, obedience, and humility that is required to make great barbecue. Great barbecue is not a matter of slapping things together and going bam. I mean, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of tradition. It takes a lot of patience with what is going on. And I think those same qualities are the qualities of somebody who has a rich spiritual life.
I think Harold's is kind of an island of safety in what otherwise is kind of a little bit of a scary neighborhood. It's situated right near Atlanta's federal prison. But Harold's itself, which is a really small little restaurant, kind of welcomes you in with a big sign of with a cheerful pig wearing sunglasses, and it's kind of like beckoning to you to come inside. Then you come inside, and as Michael said, you've got pictures of Jesus, and you've got prayers on the walls, and you've got A1 barbecue.
So tell me, what kind of barbecue are they doing? Is this ribs? Is it pork butt? Yeah. What is it?
Yes, it is. It's the ribs are spectacular. They're ultra thick ribs. These are not sort of namby pamby baby back ribs. These are ribs with some meat on the bones. I mean, with a good chew. I mean, they're not chewy, but I mean, you really exercise your teeth, and the flavor just bursts when you bite into these ribs. They have a nice kind of crust on the outside from cooking in the pit. If you don't like ribs, they have wonderful sliced pork that is, it's softer than velvet. You can get this on a sandwich or on a plate. On the side of whatever you get that that specialty of Georgia barbecue parlors, Brunswick stew, which is a kind of vegetable and meat soup / stew that accompanies all barbecue there.
They also have a weird dish, which I actually fell in love with. It's barbecue salad. Do you know what that is?
No, what is it?
It's a green salad that's topped with barbecued pork and hot barbecue sauce. It's a very weird combination, but somehow it works. There's also a stew dog, which is a hot dog blanketed in Brunswick stew.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. But the barbecue salad I thought was kind of unique.
Is there a Harold?
There was a Harold. Harold's opened in 1947. And I believe it is now run by Harold's progeny. It's a real family kind of place. They do things there the way they have done them for years. The sandwich you get has the grill marks on the white bread because they not only cook the meat. They toast the bread on a charcoal grill, so even the bread has a kind of smoky flavor to it. This is ordinary white bread, but even that is made special at Harold's.
In fact, all of Harold's, the inside of the restaurant, has a smoky patina as if it's been burnished over the years with the smoke from the barbecue that, from the pit outside that kind of leaks into the inside. So every surface, the booths, the walls, the pictures, the menus all have this kind of, amber luster to them.
Ooh, we forgot to talk about the cornbread. Cornbread to die for. With all of your plates of barbecue, you get squares of this really wonderful kind of grainy, steamy, hot cornbread that is just wonderful for crumbling into a plate of barbecue sauce.
So all you have to do is find the prison, then find the sign of the happy pig, and then go in and you will be in pig heaven.
You'll be oinking.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Michael.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Well, I like great big bones with lots of meat. I like lots of bread and slaughtered. Just load it down with good hot sauce. Well, I don't care how much it costs, 'cause I like barbecue. Hey, hey, good barbecue. Well, I love that stuff and my baby loves it too.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. Every week you can hear them here on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website. Now, while you're there, check out their recipe for cracklin' bread muffins. You can find it all at splendidtable.org. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is co-author with her husband, Ed McCarthy, of the Wine for Dummies series of books. She can make the most complicated information intelligible. Mary, good to have you back.
Nice to be here, Lynn.
Mary, for all the years I've spent in the food business, I still find sherry incredibly confusing. Can you explain what in heaven's name it is and what we can do with it?
You know, I'm not surprised because sherry is, it's more than just a wine. It's a whole category of wines and a very complex category. Sherry is basically one of the classic fortified wines of the world, fortified because alcohol has been added to it during the production process. And sherry comes from a tiny vineyard area in southern Spain, right on the Atlantic Ocean. It's a white wine. I mean, it starts out as a white wine. It gets darker with age. But it's predominantly from the Palomino grape, which is a totally unremarkable, undistinguished grape variety that doesn't do particularly well anywhere else in the world. I think what's confusing about sherry is that there are almost a dozen different styles of sherry. Some of them are dry, some of them are sweetened, some of them are delicate, some of them are rich, some of them are pale in color, some of them are dark in color, almost a deep walnut color or an amber, you know, dark amber. And so you have an enormous diversity in this category that's called sherry.
Can you give us a starting place?
Well, I think the basic way of understanding sherry is to realize that the two issues that account for all this diversity of styles, one is the aging, and the other is whether it's sweetened or not. In terms of the aging, some sherry ages in barrels, and it ages under a coating of yeast. And the yeast can be maybe as thick as your finger or maybe two fingers thick. And the yeast protects the wine and creates certain changes in the flavor and the texture of the wine. But bottom line is the sherries that age under the yeast, they're generally called pheno-type sherries, and they're fresh, they're pale in color, and they have delicate flavors. The other style of sherry ages without the yeast coating. So the wine is exposed to the air and the wine basically oxidizes, taking on sort of nutty flavors and a darker color. And those are called Oloroso type sherry. So the two basic categories, Fino and Oloroso. And then the other issue is whether a sherry is sweetened or not. Sherry always starts out dry, and originally sherries were dry, but they've been sweetened in the marketing process to make them more appealing to people. For example, cream sherries are sweetened Oloroso type sherries, and they've been sweetened to appeal to the market. But now the trend line actually in sherry is that people are drinking sherry drier, and the producers are making sherries drier. So we're going to see more and more of the delicate fino style sherries, especially one called Manzanilla that's becoming very popular now. It's a fino sherry that comes from one particular town. It's aged in one particular town where the yeast coating gets very thick. And as a result, the sherry is a little bit more delicate and finer than a phenotype sherry that comes from, that ages in any of the other towns of the zone.
Well, how would you serve a phenotype sherry?
Well, I like to use fino sherries and manzanillas as aperitifs. I love to serve them with almonds and green olives and shrimp. They're wonderful with any sort of little nibble foods like that. And generally, they're dry. Usually, they are very dry, so they're very good with that kind of food. You do have to refrigerate them, and they have to be fresh. And some producers, such as Hidalgo, which makes a brand called La Gitana Manzanilla, it's one of my favorites. And they're shipping it now in half bottles, which is a good idea because when you buy it in a half bottle, you can keep it fresh. It stays fresh longer because mm-hmm. you don't have half of the bottle left over going bad in your refrigerator.
Now, what about the Oloroso sherries? How do you serve those?
They're good after dinner with cheese, with nuts. I like them with Manchego, that wonderful, I think maybe it's the only cheese in the world that can give Parmigiano Reggiano a run for its money. It's a fabulous Spanish cheese. And there's another style, actually, Amontillado, which is sort of in the fino family, which is fabulous with soup. I like to drink it with soup, but also I like to pour a little bit into the soup. And it's fun to let your guests do that themselves rather than adding it to the soup when mm-hmm. you make the soup, mm-hmm. because they can taste the soup without the sherry, and then they can pour a little bit of sherry from their glass into the soup, and it really adds another dimension to the soup. It's just a wonderful little exercise.
Do you serve sherry cold or at room temperature?
Well, the fino and manzanillas you have to chill. And the Oloroso styles, the Amontillados, you can serve at room temperature.
Okay. Hey, Mary, thank you.
You're welcome.
Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is co-author with her husband Ed McCarthy of the Wine for Dummies series of books. You can find her sherry information on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, coming up, a new take on coffee with master roaster and coffee buyer Kevin Knox, the real scoop on Earl Grey, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites.
Let me espresso, my love. I'm in love with a coffee bean.
Whatever's happening to the economy right now, we Americans are still happily spending several dollars for a single cup of coffee. Sales of all kinds of coffee makers are still strong, and there has never been so many different kinds of coffee for sale. So how do you sort through the choices? Our guest today buys and roasts coffee for a living. He is Kevin Knox, master roaster and coffee buyer for Allegro Coffee and former coffee specialist for Starbucks. His book is Coffee Basics, a quick and easy guide. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Kevin, let's talk about coffee roasts. If you go into specialty coffee shops, the thing you usually see are these very dark roasts. Now, is this the best way to taste a coffee? Is this where you get all the flavor?
No, it's not, and it's certainly a common misconception. What people most often see in specialty stores are these glossy, shiny-looking beans that, of course, are in complete contrast with the, you know, very light cinnamon-colored coffee that many of us grew up with. And dark roasted coffee, French roasted coffee, has become so prevalent that people may think that it's synonymous with specialty coffee. But in reality, there's a lot more diversity of flavor out there if you dig a little deeper.
Well, what would you like us to taste?
I think that the most important thing to becoming an informed consumer of specialty coffee is to kind of taste the building blocks of coffee flavor, which is to say, taste pure, unblended coffees from a single growing region and farm, what we call single origin or varietal coffees. And in particular, to taste representative examples of coffees from Central and South America, from East Africa, and from Indonesia, which are kind of the three food groups, if you will, of coffee. And to taste those coffees roasted no darker than a chestnut brown color, which is what we call a classic full city roast.
So not the dark, dark beans.
No, the dark roasts are, in a really dark roast, the coffee serves merely as a vehicle for the power of the process. You taste a smoky, charred taste, and really, it could be almost any cereal grain. It hardly matters that it's coffee beans used for that purpose. What you're tasting is, well, for example, a really dark French roast, and it's a little bit odd to think about putting this in your system, but a really dark French roast is 20% carbon by weight. So, you know, maybe Kingsford Briquettes might make a worthy substitute for that product.
Yeah, but wait a minute. All these specialty coffee places, you know, like Starbucks and Caribou and whatever, that's what they sell us. That's what they're telling us has great taste.
Well, you know, French roast is a bestseller in those places, but I'll tell you, the coffee buyers for those places don't drink that stuff, and some of them even look down on those who do. I remember one coffee buyer who shall remain nameless saying, well, French roast sells only to people who really like burnt toast.
Well, very interesting. What about the seasons of coffee? We're now hearing about seasonal coffee. Now, is this also hype like the French roast business?
No, you know, this is something that once you get into the world of origin coffees, of farm-designated coffees, you become much more sensitive to the seasonality of coffees. And the reality is that coffee, once it arrives here in the U.S., is at its best for about 6 months after the harvest. And then it gradually starts to fade and a little bit of woodiness kind of creeps in. So, for example, the prime Central American coffees, your Costa Rican, your Guatemalan Antigua, those great coffees show up here starting in about May and are at their best through November, December. Conversely, Colombian coffees, the majority of that crop shows up here in December. It's at its best in the winter months. And more appropriately, in terms of the weather outside, the really hearty, heavy, rich Indonesian coffees like Sumatra, Sulawesi, the very underestimated coffees from Papua New Guinea, they all show up in the U.S. because of the harvest cycle that they're on during our winter months, and they're winter weight coffees that are just delightful when it's cold outside.
Mm-hmm.
So the seasonality is something that really is worth paying attention to.
Okay. So we buy it. It's good for 6 months after it gets here, and we try to buy what's in season. What should we look for?
Well, I think that the most important things to look for are freshness of the coffee. That is to say, making sure that it's freshly roasted, having a package, or better yet, a person who can tell you when the product was roasted, and making sure that that coffee, if it is sitting unprotected from the elements in a bin, hasn't been there for more than 2 weeks at the outside. there's an assumption, which certainly has been encouraged by some of the larger mass marketers, that if the coffee's in whole bean form, that it's guaranteed to be fresh. And the reality is that's not true. You can learn to look for some telltale signs. One of them is when you buy fresh coffee and you pour water on it in your coffee pot, it actually froths and foams from the residual carbon dioxide gas that is naturally present. So if you buy coffee and your coffee doesn't do that, it just sits there and takes the water in, it's not as fresh as it should be. The other thing is if the bins that the coffee is in have kind of a cocoa powder or almost carob-like smell, mm-hmm. that's an indication that the coffee is several weeks and possibly several months old, and you'd be better off shopping elsewhere.
How do you like to brew your coffee?
I really like simple handmade brewing methods. The French press, or plunger pot as it's also known, where you just plunge a stainless steel disc through a bed of grounds, is probably the simplest way to brew great coffee. And a plain old pour-over drip maker, something like a Melitta filter cone that brews into a thermos, mm-hmm. brews fantastic coffee. The electric drip units that are so pervasive in the U.S., tend not to get the water hot enough. They tend to take too long to brew. And let's face it, many people tend to never clean those once they're installed underneath their kitchen counter. So really, the quality of the coffee that I get at home using, you know, a $35 or $40 setup, which is a filter cone and a Melitta filter and a thermos, beats what you can get out of any fancy electric drip coffee maker.
You've just saved me a fortune. So Kevin, what are you guys who buy coffee drinking right now?
Well, in all honesty, most people that I know that buy coffee just dote on lively, bright, fruity, rather tart, or dare we say acidic coffees that many consumers haven't been exposed to. But this isn't really the season for them. Their season is summer and early fall. So I know an awful lot of coffee buyers who this time of year, although they probably wouldn't admit it, are really doting on teas that have similar characteristics.
Kevin, thank you.
My pleasure.
Kevin Knox is master roaster and coffee buyer for Allegro Coffee. He's author of Coffee Basics, A Quick and Easy Guide. When you're buying premium coffee, it's hard to tell if the label is describing how it was roasted or where the coffee comes from. Well, there is a code, and essentially it's from Kevin's book. The kind of roast is described with these words: city, full city, Vienna, Italian, or French. And by the way, that's going from lightest to darkest roast. When it says, for instance, Guatemalan Antigua, Kenya, or Sumatra, that's telling you where the coffee comes from. Now, if you'd like to try an easy dessert made with espresso coffee, take a look at my espresso ricotta cream with espresso chocolate sauce. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Tea merchant Bill Waddington has joined me in the studio. Bill spent the last 20 years tracking teas all over the world. He's been giving us a tea primer here on the air. Bill, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
There is something I've been dying to ask you for a long time. Who was Earl Grey?
There actually was an Earl Grey. He actually served as the Prime Minister of England in the 1830s, 1840s for a couple of years. He was the second Earl of Grey. His first name was Charles. Uh-huh. And legend has it that Earl Grey tea is named after him, and that it was a secret recipe developed by the Chinese emperor and given to Earl Grey and his family in return for a favor that the Earl of Grey did for the Chinese emperor. Big legend. Maybe some fact behind it, but no one knows for sure.
How do teas get their names? I mean, I'm thinking of things like gunpowder tea, and there's all these dragon names.
Sometimes it's fanciful, sometimes there's a real reason, but I like the fanciful names the most. Gunpowder. Gunpowder is a tightly rolled pellet of tea. And legend has it, when the Britishers first saw gunpowder pellets, because they look like little pellets, reminded them of the gunpowder used on clipper ships to fire the cannon, the large pieces of gunpowder. And it's as good an explanation as I've ever heard. A lot of times you'll see teas with the name monkey in them. For instance, I have one here called Snow Monkey Green, or you may see teas that are called monkey pick teas. For the longest time, the Chinese had convinced, particularly the English, that the best teas in the world were hand-picked by monkeys that were sent up to climb to the tops of trees and off of cliffs to pick leaves that were inaccessible by human hands. Totally fanciful, but they make for a great tea.
Probably an expensive one, too, if you tell them that you had to train the monkeys.
They tend to be expensive. I even know some merchants today who still sell monkey-picked teas that are... They don't deny the rumors that these were picked by monkeys, though.
I'd buy that.
Yeah.
What about the idea of... I remember a long time ago you alluded to the fact that tea was a state secret in China.
Absolutely. For centuries, China was the only place that knew how to make tea. So much so that once England became a tea-drinking empire, China was almost bankrupting England because they could get tea from nowhere else. So my favorite tea story of all time involves a gentleman by the name of Robert Fortune, who was a spy. He was actually a botanist, but he was sent into the hinterlands of China to discover the secrets of tea growing and manufacture. He went in and he spent over 2 years in China, disguised as a Chinese gentleman, passing himself off as a native. And whenever anybody would question him about his accent, he would say, well, I'm from the far reaches of China, past the Great Wall. He spent 2 years in China. There was a price on his head. England had long given him up for lost. And after a little over two years, he came out of China with a pack train with dozens of tea masters from China, thousands of tea seeds, and over 12,000 tea plants packed. And that eventually that were transported to India, and that led to the Indian tea empire.
Now when was this again?
Late 1840s, early 1850s.
And his name was Robert Fortune?
Isn't that a great name for a spy?
You'd think he made it up. Fascinating. Bill, thank you.
It's been fun, Lynn. Thanks.
Tea expert Bill Waddington is proprietor of The Tea Source in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can get Bill's tea advice on our website, splendidtable.org. British author Jim Crace writes about life in small-town England. The last time we heard from him, he had a twisted tale about charity and human nature coming together at the food shelf. Well, today it's a lesson in child-rearing and marketing.
More than 40 years ago, in simpler times, our produce wholesaler, by way of an experiment in exotica, bought a consignment of kumquats, cheaply, off a storm-docked cargo boat. Well, cheaply if he could pass them all on to his retailers, and quickly. Then he'd make a profit. He gave the problem of disposing of this unfamiliar fruit to his raw and unpersuasive son. But after 2 days of softening and maturing at the depot, the kumquats were, mostly, still unsold. "People don't want kumquats, whatever they might be," his son explained. "They just want simple oranges. This isn't Paris, don't blame me." "Well, give them simple oranges." His father took a fat black marker from his desk and underneath the word kumquats on the display card wrote, "AKA Pygmy Oranges." They'd made their profit by the end of the day. Pygmy oranges were all the rage, just right for kids and snacks and picnics. They could be eaten whole, no peel, no mess, no lacquered chins. How had our town got by without this infant fruit for so long? The retailers demanded more, but our wholesaler could not discover any fresh supplies. He couldn't count on any more storm-docked boats. "That's life," his son said. 10 days ago, they didn't want to know. Today, they want kumquats and won't settle for anything else. Oranges are far too vulgar now." "Well, give them kumquats," his father said. "The wholesaler should always come up with the goods." He took the same fat pen from his desk, found the display card for oranges, and wrote below, "AKA Kingquats." He gave his son a knowing, weary look. He hoped this twice-explained lesson had been learned, that if customers were soft enough to like their oranges reduced, then they'd be bound to love their kumquats swollen and resized. This was his understanding from a life in trade. The buying public were as innocent as kids. They'd always pay to see the scale of life disrupted by the pygmies and the kings.
Yes, if you want to ring the cash register bell, get a slogan that'll sell.
Novelist Jim Crace is author of The Devil's Larder. lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got David on the line. So, David, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I've heard that Tibet is now importing some yak cheese.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you were familiar with that, and I've heard that it's supposed to be fairly healthy and kind of a distinct flavor. Wondering if you know where I could get that.
Well, I think you may have heard about it on The Splendid Table.
Okay.
Yeah, we did an interview with Jonathan White, who is the man who went to Tibet and was working with the people there.
Okay.
And Nepal, as I recall. I my memory is. And you can find information on the yak cheese on our website.
Okay.
Splendidtable.org.
All right.
And I think that we've got sources up there as well. Now you wanted to know what to do with it?
Yeah, that was my other question as well. Was what would you use it for? What would you just eat it like on a sandwich or?
I haven't tasted the cheese, but quite frankly, I think something like this I'd want to treat being very special. So I'd have perhaps crackers with it or some sort of bread, but really make the focus the yak cheese. I've not tasted it. I've not been able to get any yet. But my bet is because I remember hearing that it was a high fat cheese, meaning it's going to be kind of velvety and creamy. It's probably going to be the kind of thing that if you want to have any accompaniment, make it something like thin sliced pear, which always complements cheeses that have a full flavor to them.
Okay.
But I don't think this is ham sandwich material, if you know what
okay.
I mean. No, because you know why? A, it's going to be expensive. B, it's really special. So let's make it the star.
Okay.
But check out the Splendid Table website. You'll find information there.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Do you know that the idea of having cheese that doesn't come from a cow or sheep or a goat isn't anything really new? And a long, long time ago, I asked a cheese expert why we didn't have pig cheese. And they explained, I hadn't thought it out very well. First of all, imagine trying to milk a pig. You know, they're very low to the ground. This is not an easy thing to do. Secondly, they don't give a lot of milk. But do you know what did exist at one time? It was called thimble cheese, and it was cheese made from mother's milk. You never know what you find out these days when you ask a question. Speaking of questions, it's time for our weekly trivia query. Now, this one was inspired by Talking Coffee with Kevin Knox. The question is, what's the world's most expensive coffee? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're going to get back to the phones in a few moments. By the way, that number is 800-537-5252. But first, I got the answer to this week's food query. It was inspired by Talking Coffee with Kevin Knox. The question is, what's the world's most expensive coffee? Well, the answer is a coffee from Vietnam and Indonesia, and it wholesales for around $100 a pound. It can retail for over $300 a pound. It's got several names, all of them nigh on to impossible to pronounce. It's called Kopi Luwak in Indonesia. In Vietnam, it's a three-part name, Cafe Kut Chan, and in English, it's Civet Cat Coffee. Well, that's the giveaway. Because this isn't just the most expensive coffee in the world. It's one of a handful of coffees processed in a unique way. In Indonesia and Vietnam, a weasel-like animal called the civet cat eats coffee beans right off the coffee plant. I think you know where this is going. Connoisseurs believe that the civet cat always goes for the choicest beans. Now, once they pass through its digestive system, they are incredible. All you do is roast them and enjoy a dark, rich coffee. Although one expert told me she thinks it just tastes funky. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We've got Matt on the line. So, Matt, what's on your mind?
I've traveled in Spain and come across a dessert, which is, it's sometimes lemon, sometimes orange, and it's sort of a, it seems like it's a mix of fruit and vanilla ice cream, but I'm not sure, served inside of the skin of the fruit and frozen.
Ooh, so it would be inside the lemon or inside the orange or something?
Yeah, I see. They use either a very large lemon or, you know, an ordinary size orange. The top is cut off so that you can get your spoon in, and then it's, you know, frozen ice cream-like concoction that's delicious. And I was wondering if you've heard of it and might have some guidance on how to recreate it.
I've not heard of it. I'm familiar with desserts of that kind in France.
Uh-huh.
And that style of serving is done in a lot of places.
Okay.
There's ices and sorbets,
yeah,
you know, served, the fruit served in the fruit,
yeah,
that are done all over.
Okay.
You're sure that, is there a cream? There is a cream base, so it's almost like vanilla ice cream with the fruit in it.
It was just so creamy tasting.
Ah.
It was my impression that it might have been like an orange sickle or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A dreamsicle. Remember? Yeah. Or a creamsicle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's two things it could be. First of all, it could be a sorbet done in a sorbet machine.
Okay.
Where you get this incredibly creamy texture, but what you're dealing with is something that's made with fruit and sugar syrup and flavoring.
Yeah.
And if you have access to an ice cream machine or a sorbet machine,
I'll buy whatever I need.
You'll buy? Oh, we are serious. This is investment time, right?
These were so good. It's been a few years. And
you've never forgotten them,
oh,
right?
My goodness.
I know what you mean. Yeah, there are those things that hang on all the time.
Yeah, on a hot day, it was remarkable.
Well, I think, is that a little ice cream eater in the background?
Yeah, he's dying to have one of these, too.
Okay, for his sake and for yours, two things. Number one, try the obvious, which is take the fruit.
Yeah.
And stir it into softened vanilla ice cream, hollow out the orange or the, you know, the lemon, pack it in and freeze it.
Yeah.
And that's step number one, and that can be absolutely delicious.
Yeah.
Step number two would be you take a cup of sugar, a half a cup of water. That's your basic proportion, as I recall.
Yeah.
A pinch of salt. Simmer that on the stove until it's clear.
Simple syrup,
right. Essentially. Chill that down, and if you're doing lemon or you're doing orange, put lots of zest in it as it's simmering.
Oh, okay.
You know, whatever fruit it is, put some in there. And then what you do is add to that the juice or the pulp of the fruit. So for 1.5 cups or 1 cup of syrup, I'd use 1 cup of fruit. It's going to be very dense.
Yeah.
And put that into your ice cream machine. Always remember a pinch of salt.
Okay.
And one other trick. Remember, acid is great with acid flavors. And with anything in the stone fruit family.
Yes.
But almond extract is also wonderful with stone fruits.
Oh.
If you remember that, it brings out a taste in peaches, nectarines, that kind of thing. That's just fabulous.
Okay, that's almond extract.
Almond extract, very little.
Okay.
You know, for the amount we're talking about, I'd use an eighth of a teaspoon.
But you wouldn't use it for citrus?
No, for citrus, it disappears.
Yeah, okay.
Black pepper in citrus, not a bad thing. A little chili in the citrus, not a bad thing.
Okay,
and then pack it in and freeze it.
Yeah.
And that'll do it for you.
Great.
Okay?
Thanks for your help.
Hey, and if you remember the name of what this dessert was, we'd love to know it.
Okay, if I come across it, I'll give you a ring.
Okay, you're
Thank
on.
You. Bye-bye.
Take care, Matt. You know, there's one other thing I should have mentioned to Matt. Blood oranges come into season. You know, like in February, March, and blood orange sorbet, which you'd make exactly the same way. Absolutely delicious. And you can puree the pulp, and of course it looks incredible. You've got this stain of deep mahogany and then orange. And they almost taste like someone added maple syrup and lemon to an orange. A good blood orange tastes like that. It's a beautiful thing to see. Blood orange sorbet packed into the blood orange that you've hollowed out. Okay, let's see who's next. Doug's on the line. Doug, what pressing issue do you want to discuss?
Well, hi, Lynn. I don't know if it's pressing, but it's sort of a question I just wondered.
Mm-hmm.
When cooking something with a Mediterranean type of flavor,
yeah,
some sort of stew or sauce, I wondered about putting the liquid or the juice from olives, when you're working with olives, into that to add some of the salt and to add some of the flavor. It sort of came up when I was talking with my son about adding anchovies and capers and things that aren't really food, but you add them for the saltiness and the richness. And I've never seen it mentioned in a cookbook, ever.
You know, it's an interesting point. This is what comes to mind. I'd rather add the olive, because the brine, olives evidently are cured in many ways, but the fast way is in a lye solution, and that's really not very tasty. And the slow and traditional way is generally in a salt brine, as you said. But if you've ever tasted those brines, they're not something sometimes that you really want to have in any quantity, although you are talking about a small amount. See, what I'm thinking is add the olive. Because you'd get some of that lovely flavor and meatiness as well as the salt. The beauty of the very things you were telling, you know, your child about is that each one of them brings not only salt to the party, but it brings some character, some depth of some kind. Real subtle, you'd never know it's there, but it's there. And I think the brine, you'd have to taste it. If it tasted good, then it would go in. If it tasted really funky or very strong, then I'd be careful with it.
Right, right. Come to think of it, the only time I've ever actually seen it done is at a bar when you order a martini and they put, maybe if you ask them, put a little extra bit of the juice from the olive or onion into the...
Now I know what I've been missing, not drinking martinis. Although someone just ordered something like a martini and recently and had mushrooms in it, and they tasted absolutely wonderful.
Pepperoncini are good, too.
Yeah, well, see, there you go.
Okay.
I've been missing out on a whole realm of cuisine here. It's throw out the drink and eat what's in it. But I'd say taste the brine. You know,
well, if it's good tasting and it's a high quality olive,
that's right.
A little bit couldn't hurt, I guess.
But the other thing is, think about one or two olives in there.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, the Italians, I know everybody's probably doing this, but I grew up with my grandmother throwing olives into a stew or throwing olives into a sauté. And you didn't even eat the olives in most cases, but they gave this great flavor.
Got it.
You got it. Okay. Take care, Doug.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We're taking your calls at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who has been waiting patiently? We've got Alexandra on the line. So, Alexandra, what's up?
Hello, Lynn.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Let me tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Oh, go on. Don't hold back. It's all right.
I listen every Sunday, and I love it.
Thank you, dear. Can we do anything for you? I mean, if you call to say nice things, we can just sit here forever and listen. I love
we
it.
We could do that, but I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
It might be tripartite or twofold. I'm not quite sure.
Well, we will see.
I'm recently unemployed for the first time in my life.
Ah.
And I was wondering, for myself and on behalf of all the others who have been going through this.
Yeah, you're an excellent company, as you well know.
Right. I was wondering about inexpensive cuts of meat, how to use them, as well as leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
Have a crock pot. I've done like a bunch of pork loin roast stuffed with fruit and all this other stuff.
Right.
You know, the usual things. And so I'm getting a bit bored with that. And then I'm also trying to explore Persian and Indian cooking using beans, even though I really don't like beans because I know they're a good source of protein and they're cheaper than meat.
And that's true.
And I was wondering if you had ideas about inexpensive cuts of meat, how to use them, and then what to do with beans that I really don't like except for lentil soup.
We may be able to tie those two together. Because if you look at cuisines like the cuisines of India,
mm-hmm,
or Asia or much of the third world, meat is a condiment. It's the flavoring. But the main bulk of the food is in complex carbohydrates, lentils, beans, rice, you know, whole wheat berries,
mm-hmm,
the grains boiled. And when you start mixing that with interesting seasonings,
uh-huh,
and veggies,
okay,
and of course a ton of garlic has never hurt anything,
right,
and then you have a little bit of meat cooked with that,
mm-hmm,
You really have something that you don't feel like you're eating economically. You just feel like you're eating really well. And it can go a long way in making those legumes much more interesting for you. So I'll give you an instance. All right.
Okay.
One of my favorite cuts of beef is the chuck.
The chuck.
It's the shoulder.
Okay.
Dynamite flavor, great marbling. There are pieces of it that if you cook them rare and you don't mind chewing a little bit, they are as good tasting as any great steak. But the other thing about the chuck is it has fat, and the fat makes it taste good, and a little bit of it goes a long way. So let's say, for instance, you like the Indian flavors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I've got all the spices.
You got all the spices? Oh, so you've made the investment.
Yeah, I've stocked.
All right, you've stocked. This is going to be a bastard Indian dish because I'm sort of making it up off the top of my head, but it's the idea, okay? And you can play with this.
Okay.
You're going to take a ton of onions. You're going to take a ton of garlic. So I'm talking two nice-sized onions. And you're going to slice those up. And you'll take a little bit of vegetable oil or mix that with a little bit of butter. And you'll saute those onions. And then you're going to add about 6 or 7 cloves of garlic. And you'll...
Whoa.
Well, I'm making something you're going to feed a lot of people with. You can cut this back if you want to.
Okay, no, this sounds great.
Invite everybody who's, you know, who's out of work.
Yeah,
they're
going to
love this.
My building's out of work.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, and everybody brings a dish. They can bring a vegetable. So the idea is that you're going to saute that, and then you're going to add about, take a 4-inch piece of ginger and chop that up. You know, peel it and chop it. Stir that in and saute that. And then add your spices, like cardamom, cinnamon, a little hot chili. Okay? Cumin.
Turmeric or not?
Turmeric. Absolutely. Absolutely. A little, you know, cumin and coriander. They're going to be real fragrant. Real fragrant. Now you stir in some rice. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you stir in some lentils.
Lentils.
And you stir in maybe 1 pound of chuck that you've cut up in small bite-sized pieces. And to that, you add some water, or if you have it, broth.
Okay.
All right.
Now, how do I make sure I put in the correct amount of water according to the rice?
For every cup of rice, you need 3 cups of water.
3 cups of water?
Yep. And since you're going to have lentils in there, for every cup of lentil, you'll need about 2 cups of water.
Okay. So
it's going to be stewy. All right. Then you cover the pan.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you have salt and pepper in there, and you let it cook until the rice is tender.
Very cool.
So that's it.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Goodbye. Where else but on the Splendid Table are you going to hear a version of an Indian dish that uses beef? To all the listeners from India, please forgive me. Lamb's very pricey. And everybody's tired of chicken, I think. Okay, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now we have Ron waiting. Ron, thanks for waiting, and what can we do for you?
Yeah, well, my question's about flaxseed. I've heard it's an important source of omega-3 fatty acids. So I went out and bought some, but now I don't know what to do with it.
You sound like me. I find something that looks good, I buy it, and then it sits there and I stare at it for a while. This is a great way to learn, though. Have you tried anything with it at all?
I've tried eating the seeds, just eating the seeds.
How do you like them?
They taste fine.
Yeah, they taste kind of nutty, right?
Right, very nutty.
Mm-hmm. So you want to know what to do with them.
Yeah, do you grind them? Do you sprinkle them on salads? Do you mash them up?
Well, there's a ton of stuff. I mean, you can grind them into a paste. They generally taste great, used in ways that, if you think about it, are pretty obvious. For instance, multigrain breads that you might make.
Okay.
You know, if you've got a 3-grain bread recipe you like, stirring a cup of flax seeds, either whole or crushed into it, is going to be great.
So there's no problem with eating them just the way they are?
No, from as far as I know, none at all.
Okay.
Sprinkle them over salads.
Yeah.
You know, again, and I like that kind of crunch. I do that with pumpkin seeds and other seeds. Flax seeds probably work the same way.
You can use them like wheat germ.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Any place where you've got a recipe that has nuts in it, use flaxseed instead, or mix flaxseed in.
How about shelf life? How long is it last?
I keep them in the fridge.
Okay.
Maybe I'm going overboard, but since things can turn rancid and that kind of thing, because they have a lot, things like that have a lot of oil in them.
Right.
I'd stick them in the fridge, or even in the freezer.
Okay. I run into 2 colors. There's a light brown and a dark brown.
Well, I always go for the dark color because I figure it tastes better, but that probably has no reality.
Okay. And I also have organic versus regular.
And, well, you know me. I'm the organic queen.
Right.
I'd go for organic. But tuck them in the freezer or the fridge and sprinkle them on any place you want crunch. Put them in a meatloaf.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, isn't that a great idea?
Yeah.
Try that.
All righty.
I'm thinking of everyday stuff, you know, in hamburgers, that kind of thing.
Right.
Oh, wait a minute. I just thought of one other place. Sauerkraut. They're great. I've had flaxseed and sauerkraut. It's good.
Just sprinkled on top or cooked with it?
Just thrown in at the last minute so they're real crunchy.
Right. So in other words, you'd like to use them like sesame seeds. Or
yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right, great.
And you'll get all that healthy omega-3 stuff.
Good.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this toast. Be careful. The toes you step on today could be connected to the bottom you kiss tomorrow. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. You can find it right there on our homepage. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.